Okay, well, we are near the beginning of a series that we are teaching through that will take us probably to the end of the year. And we're entitling this series Resilient. And of course, the goal is to create and cultivate a resiliency in us as people. And we're doing that because we feel like we need it. I think many of us feel unsettled as we look around the world. It feels unstable. Now, the world always feels unstable. In every age, it feels like that society is kind of teetering. But many of us feel it especially acutely now. It just feels like the world is pretty unsettling. And with that in mind, we feel the need to work this kind of resiliency and endurance and strength into our church. And so, what we are doing is tackling some different ideas that we think will help to create that kind of resiliency. Now, this is a different kind of sermon series. It's really a collection of mini series. And what we're going to do is, for typically about 3 weeks at a time, we're going to tackle various topics that our world is wrestling with. Various issues out there, often that people are arguing about. So, Travis kicked us off during the past 3 weeks talking about technology, knowing that technology is one of those topics that we have to get our arms around and understand well and make sure that we're not enslaved by our technology. And so we spent 3 weeks on that. If you haven't listened to any of those messages, I would strongly encourage you to listen to them. And understand the world that we live in. I think you brought a lot of sobriety, but also a lot of hope. And so I really encourage you to listen to those messages. But not only listen to them, my big encouragement this morning is to make sure that you settle on a tangible application coming out of those messages. Because I don't think it would be good just to hear all of that for 3 weeks and be unchanged. Do we really want to understand our world and then make appropriate changes to make sure that God is center in our lives? And so, I would like to ask you over this next week, if you haven't already, get some time with God and think through those things with Him and ask, what should I do? What should I do coming out of those 3 weeks about technology? And then tell somebody. Don't tell somebody how He's moving you to get a handle on your technology. Okay? So, he introduced that for those 3 weeks. We're going to have another series of mini-series where for a few weeks at a time, we'll handle different topics kind of like that. Again, topics that our world is wrestling with. However, between those mini-series, we're going to teach through the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, so this famous sermon from Jesus, the longest recorded sermon in the Bible, Matthew 5-7, we're going to teach through that as we're going along. So we'll take 3 weeks on a topic, then now we're going to do 5 weeks introducing the Sermon on the Mount. Then we're going to go back to another topic that we're wrestling with, and then we'll go back to the Sermon on the Mount, and we're going to go back and forth like that throughout the rest of the year. And the Sermon on the Mount, I believe, is going to be very powerful for us. Okay, this again is a very famous sermon from Jesus. Many of you are familiar with it, although you may be confused by it in a lot of ways. Even those that are not very familiar with it, you've probably heard sound bites from it. Some of the most famous sayings from Jesus are in this sermon. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Judge not that you be not judged, and on. There are these very famous sayings from Jesus. But at the end of this sermon, he makes some resiliency-building statements. So in Matthew 7:24-25, he says, "Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on the house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock." And we want to build our foundation on the rock. And so that's why we're doing this. So we're going to spend a few weeks now on the Sermon on the Mount before we turn into a pertinent topic for our day. And then we're going to work through the sermon for the rest of the year. So this morning, it's my job to introduce us to the Sermon on the Mount. And this will be a lot of introduction and overview and context and an attempt to set us up for future teachings. And so I'm just going to take the first three verses of the Sermon on the Mount. I'll read those now. Seeing the crowds, he, Jesus, went up on the mountain. And when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And so again, there's just context. We're introduced to this sermon, what Jesus does. He goes up on this mountain, he sits down, and he begins to teach his disciples. And then he begins with the first, what we call, beatitude. And then for the first 12 verses, the beatitudes are described, these blessings that are given to these groups of people. And so we're going to cover the first beatitude this morning, but really introduce that with a lot of context and overview, like I was describing. So, what we'll do this morning is we're going to start broadly, and I want to just talk about the Gospel of Matthew. What do we need to know about the Gospel of Matthew? And then we'll narrow a little bit, and we'll ask, what do we need to know about the Sermon on the Mount? And then narrow further and say, what do we need to know about the Beatitudes, this introduction to the Sermon on the Mount? And then finally, what do we need to know about the first Beatitude? So that's where we're going this morning. So let's start with the Gospel of Matthew and try to understand what we need to know about this to set us up to understand the Sermon on the Mount. Of course, there's a lot that we could understand about Matthew's gospel. Matthew was one of the 12 disciples of Jesus, and he wrote this account of Jesus' life and ministry. Of course, there were four gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they all write down accounts of Jesus' life and ministry. And they were inspired by God. And so the words that they wrote, God guided. And this is God's truth, his words. And yet at the same time, in this mysterious way, each writer, God allowed to retain some of their personality and their perspective. And so we see four different perspectives. And they're not contradictory, they're very complementary. And they add so much color and texture as we see how each disciple saw things from a slightly different angle. And so there are distinctives in Matthew. I'm just going to tell you two things about the Gospel of Matthew that I think will help as we go through the Sermon on the Mount. Number one, Matthew shows Jesus to be the fulfillment of Old Testament history. Now, each of the Gospel writers do this to an extent, but Matthew does this, where he is trying to show that Jesus is the culmination of everything that was written in the Old Testament. So a couple subpoints there. Events in the life of Jesus reflect Old Testament events, and you just see this throughout Matthew. Matthew set up his gospel. He recorded things and arranged things very intentionally to highlight things. And he is showing how Jesus' life reflects what God, the history that God had unrolled in the Old Testament. I'm going to let John Stott explain that a little bit. As Israel was oppressed in Egypt under the despotic rule of Pharaoh, so the infant Jesus became a refugee in Egypt under the despotic rule of Herod. As Israel passed through the waters of the Red Sea, so Jesus passed through the waters of John's baptism in the River Jordan. As Israel was tested in the wilderness of Zin for 40 years, so Jesus was tested in the wilderness of Judea for 40 days. As Moses from Mount Sinai gave Israel the law, so Jesus from the Mount of Beatitudes gave his disciples the true interpretation and amplification of the law. So you just see this in Jesus, and again, it's very intentional. Jesus was intentional in what he did in his life, and Matthew was intentional in how he recorded it to highlight these types of things. And so these events of Jesus' life reflect Old Testament events, specifically. The mountain is highlighted in Matthew with seven key moments from the ministry of Jesus taking place on a mountain. So beginning with Jesus' temptation by Satan, Satan takes him up to a high mountain and shows him all the kingdoms of the earth and offers them to him.
And then at the very end of Matthew, Jesus meets his disciples and commissions them on this mountain. And it seems like Matthew is just pointing out Jesus was on these mountains, different points in his life, and he's reflecting something. And he's really showing himself to be the new and better Moses. Moses declared God's truth and God's law from the mountain. And Jesus does the same, but he does, as Stott says, he gives the true interpretation and amplification of what Moses said. So, Matthew shows Jesus to be the fulfillment of Old Testament history. Another thing to point out about Matthew's gospel is this: Matthew emphasizes the authority of Jesus. Okay, so this is really important. Now, each of the gospel writers could be said that they emphasize a different aspect of who Jesus was and is. And so Mark emphasizes his servanthood, and Luke his humanity, and John his deity. Well, Matthew seems to emphasize Jesus as king, the authoritative king, the one who has all authority. So Matthew starts out his gospel talking about how Jesus is the king of the Jews, and the Magi came from the east looking for the king of the Jews. And then, of course, he does end his gospel saying that Jesus has been given all authority. And all in between, we see the authority of Jesus being highlighted. Jesus began his ministry by preaching the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So in Matthew, we first have the Christmas story, the birth of Jesus. Then Jesus grows up and he is baptized by John. And then he's sent out into the desert by the Holy Spirit, and he's tempted by Satan. And after that, he comes back and he begins officially his ministry. But the way it's described there is that he came preaching that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. The kingdom that was expected was here. Jesus was unrolling the kingdom here. And Matthew is sure to point that out. Matthew mentions that the crowds were astonished because Jesus taught with authority. This happens at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus got up and spoke, and Matthew said everybody was astonished because this was different. This was different than all the scribes. Jesus was speaking as one who had a weight to him. There was a gravity in his words. And so these are the things that Matthew highlights. Okay, so keep those in mind. Now let's narrow a little bit. And let's look at the Sermon on the Mount. What is the Sermon on the Mount? Well, the Sermon on the Mount is the king's inaugural address. Remember, Matthew is emphasizing Jesus' kingship. And then he begins his ministry saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And then right after that, the Sermon on the Mount is shared. And I think we can think of this as the king initiating his kingdom, really. And he's giving this address to initiate it. Now, the kingdom, there's this already and not yet, the already and not yet components of the kingdom. On one hand, the kingdom will be fully expressed at some point in the future. And yet, with the coming of Jesus, there was an introduction of the kingdom, and the kingdom is already here. The kingdom is here, and Jesus, when he went up on that mountain and sat down and began to speak to his disciples, he was giving that inaugural address. So, the sermon describes the king's standards for life in the kingdom and calls us to obedience. He calls us to follow these commands that he lays out, and he lays out some pretty high standards. Again, if you've read this sermon, you've probably been rattled by it a little bit because he sets a very high bar. I like what C.S. Lewis says about the sermon. He says, as to caring for the Sermon on the Mount, if caring for here means liking or enjoying, I suppose no one cares for it. Who can like being knocked flat on his face by a sledgehammer? I can hardly imagine a more deadly spiritual condition than that of a man who can read that passage with tranquil pleasure. And there's a reality there. It is a sledgehammer. And Jesus wields it, and it knocks us off our feet. And yet, it does so in not a disheartening way, not in a crushing way. You know, as I've been reading the Sermon on the Mount lately, I feel like it's drawing out this eagerness to pursue righteousness. It can draw out this strength in me. You know, in the Old Testament, oftentimes, especially in the Psalms, the law is spoken of as this great delight. So for example, in Psalm 119, and there are many verses in Psalm 119 that speak in this way, he says, "Therefore I love your commandments above gold, above fine gold." And the psalmist here is saying, I just delight, they're like honey on my lips, your commandments. And there's a reality there in God's commands. They are good, and they don't have to be crushing. If we see them in the right way, they can actually draw out strength and resiliency. It's like a coach. Many of us have had coaches or teachers or instructors of some kind, and they challenge us, and yet we appreciate that challenge, and it works into us this strength, this endurance. And Jesus is laying out these standards of righteousness and calling us to them. You know, we just went through a series this past year on the Old Testament law, and then we went through the book of Galatians. And in those series, we tried to teach and describe how we have been set free from the old covenant law, okay, that we're not obligated to strictly obey everything in the old covenant. However, in our emphasis on gospel grace, we shouldn't downplay the great value of obedience and the sweetness of God's commands. And here in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is transitioning us. And yes, the old covenant is being set aside, and yet he's bringing us into this new kingdom, and much of what he commanded, what God commanded in the old covenant, he takes with him and then elaborates on it, even amplifies it. And that's what he's doing here, but it calls us to a strength and an endurance. But the sermon reminds us of our dependence on the King for our citizenship and our ability to live righteously. Very high standards, and they do call a strength and resiliency out of us, but they also remind us that we are fully dependent on him, which we'll get into more in a few minutes. I like what Frank Thielman says about the sermon. He says, "In short, the sermon shows us what life should look like for a heart that has been melted and transformed by the gospel of grace, while also making clear the true nature of God's standards of righteousness. High standards, which mean that our right standing with God is ultimately dependent on the grace of the one who tells us of them." Let's narrow in a little bit more. And now let's ask about the Beatitudes. What do we need to know about the Beatitudes? Well, the Beatitudes provide the general introduction to the sermon, describing an inward character before getting to specific applications of that character. Earlier, I was trying to describe how Matthew very intentionally lays out his gospel, and Jesus very intentionally lays out his sermon, and Matthew again records, the order that he records it in is very intentional as well. And the Beatitudes provide the introduction and the foundation for the rest of the sermon. Martin Lloyd-Jones says, "We are all of us ready to fix on certain particular statements and to concentrate on them at the expense of others. The way to correct that tendency, I believe, is to realize that no part of this sermon can be understood truly except in the light of the whole." We should know that there is a structure to this sermon. And it's very intentional that the Beatitudes are right here at the beginning. They're introducing something. They're setting us up for something. That said, they begin and end with the kingdom of heaven, indicating that they reference citizens of the kingdom. So what Jesus is doing here is he is describing the inner character, the general character of those who belong to the kingdom. Basically, he is describing Christians. These are those who inherit the kingdom. They are Christians. So they are a description of every Christian, not eight individual types of people, and each beatitude demands all the others. Yeah, I think sometimes we can look at this and say, okay, right now he's talking about this certain group of people who are meek, and then there's this certain group of people who are poor in spirit, and then there's these people who mourn. I think he's talking about Christians in general, all Christians, and all Christians display these qualities and characteristics that are described in the Beatitudes. Okay, so this is talking about the general character of a Christian. And then for the rest of the sermon, he's going to expand on specific applications of that character. But he is speaking of Christians. And the Beatitudes, therefore, are all connected together. Each one relies upon the others. They're all connected. And they describe the way of happiness. They describe happiness. Blessed are those. Some people argue for the translation of happy are those. There is a blessing, there is a happiness for those that have this character, that are citizens of this kingdom. There is a true, deep happiness that is received when we receive this character. Okay, so with all of that said, now we ask, what do we need to know about the first beatitude? Remember, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Let's say a few things about this beatitude. First, there is an order to the Beatitudes, and poor in spirit is the initial and fundamental quality of a Christian that all the others rest on. So again, don't think of this sermon as a bunch of random disconnected sayings. No, again, there's intention and order to it. So the Beatitudes is the introduction, and then this first Beatitude is the introduction to the introduction. This is the fundamental quality that all the rest of the Beatitudes are resting on. So what is it? What does it mean to be poor in spirit? Well, to be poor in spirit is to recognize your spiritual poverty before God. And this is what it's saying. It's saying when you come before God and when you recognize his great power, you recognize his moral perfection, you recognize that you yourself have nothing to bring, that you are spiritually impoverished before God. I'll let D.A. Carson and Martin Lloyd-Jones again explain this more. The kingdom of heaven is not given on the basis of race, earned merits, the military zeal and prowess of zealots, or the wealth of a Zacchaeus. It is given to the poor, the despised publicans, the prostitutes, those who are so poor they know they can offer nothing and do not try. Or Martin Lloyd-Jones says, if one feels anything in the presence of God save an utter poverty of spirit, it ultimately means that you have never faced him. This is the meaning of this beatitude. When you come into the presence of God, you fall on your face. That's what it's getting at. This is the fundamental quality of a citizen of the kingdom, the fundamental quality of a Christian is to be poor in spirit. A biblical example of this, I think, can be found in Matthew chapter 8. And so right after the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus goes into describing this interaction he had with a centurion. And again, it's intentional. I believe that Matthew set this up very purposefully. And so right after this inaugural address from the king, he describes this interaction with the centurion. And this is how it goes. When he had entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly." And he said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion replied, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. but only say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, truly I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. And this is really interesting. This man, obviously, is highly commended by Jesus. He says there's a unique faith in this man. Haven't seen anything like it before. But what is unique here is maybe unexpected. Okay, if we're trying to define faith, describe biblical faith, this man gives us a good example, a good definition. And Jesus says, I've never seen any, I haven't seen faith like this. This is astounding. Well, what was characteristic of this man's faith? Well, it was his spiritual poverty. He was poor in spirit, I believe. Okay, he was not a weak man. He was an influential man. Okay, he had 100 soldiers underneath him. Probably not many of us supervise 100 people. So this man had some influence, probably some aptitude. And yet, when he encounters Jesus, he says, Jesus, I don't even deserve to have you come under my roof. Don't even step into my home. I know that I am nothing before you. And this is an example, I believe, of spiritual poverty, where he recognizes the authority of Jesus. And he recognizes that he has nothing to bring to Jesus. Or you can think of Peter, after the miraculous catch of fish. What does he do? He falls on his face before Jesus, and he says, away from me, Lord. I'm a sinful man. And again, an example of poverty of spirit, where he just acknowledges, I don't have anything to bring here. Now, this would have been revolutionary to Jesus' listeners, just as it is with us. Remember, the crowds were beginning to build. They were gathering around Jesus, and there was an expectation here, an expectation that he was the king. The kingdom was being introduced, the kingdom that they had expected for so long. And so they're ready. They sense that this is the inaugural address of the king. And then he starts out like this. And he says, the kingdom belongs to those who are poor in spirit. So those who were expecting military conquest and might, their thinking is rearranged here. And Jesus says, if you want to enter into this kingdom, you must be poor in spirit. And this is just as revolutionary for us as well. Because we tend to think that we bring something. And that self-reliance and self-assurance are really important qualities and virtues to have. Okay, that we want to bring everything that we are, and we have a lot to bring. And that's what we are told, and that's what we naturally think. And so Jesus confronts that, and he says, you know what? You actually need to be poor in spirit. You need to bring a humility. You need to acknowledge that there is nothing that you can bring. And that's how he introduces this sermon. Band, I'd like to invite you to come back on up as I close up here. We think that we have so much in ourselves to bring. We have so much spiritual aptitude. And yet Jesus opens up his sermon, confronting that self-righteous attitude, and says, you must be poor in spirit to inherit the kingdom of heaven. And he challenges us all. And we ask ourselves, am I holding on too much to what I can bring here? And do I need to have a moment of just surrender and emptying of myself and declaring that Jesus, you do everything. You bring everything. I bring nothing. That's the poverty of spirit that we are aiming for. So we are going to continue to expand upon this as we go through the rest of the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. But this is where we enter. This is the key that unlocks the door to the kingdom. It is poverty of spirit where we recognize our ineptitude and we surrender to Jesus.